loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, besieged Gazans fired on Israel last night and received massive rocket fire in return. This happened as a ceasefire was in the works. So what happened? Next, the count of fatalities in Puerto Rico during Hurricane Maria was initially assessed at 64, but according to a revised report submitted to Congress today, the number of fatalities is actually 1,427. Then, Venezuela's Supreme Court has ordered the arrest of former head of the National Assembly, Julio Borges, who currently lives in exile in Colombia. And then, Brazil's Workers' Party yesterday nominated imprisoned former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva as its presidential candidate, despite the fact that the Supreme Court will likely seek to keep him off the ballot. Meanwhile, far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro, who is a front-runner, chose an outspoken general as his running mate. General Hamilton Mourão has spoken in favor of a military coup in Brazil. And finally, we continue our series called Stories from the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where Dr. Alice Bonner highlights some of the most important episodes in Black history. Today, we talk about Ida B. Wells. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to Gaza. Besieged Gazans fired on Israel last night and received massive rocket fire in return. This happened as a ceasefire was in the works being negotiated by the Egyptians. So what happened? We're joined from Amman, Jordan by Daoud Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Welcome, Daoud.
Thank you very much.
Daoud, yesterday in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and all the other major publications here in the United States, there was talk of a ceasefire being brokered by the Egyptians. And the fact that all three parties, the Israelis, the Egyptians, and the Palestinians, wanted to reopen the Gaza crossing into Egypt. 24 hours later, we have rocket fire and already great numbers of casualties among Palestinians. So what did happen?
Well, it's not exactly clear what happened. There's clearly a lot of misunderstanding, miscommunication. But one report has it that apparently totally kind of different. There was a celebration going on in a different part of Gaza Strip, and sometimes in celebrations of a Hamas commander, somebody was shooting in the air. And apparently the Israelis thought they were shooting at them, and they considered that a break of the ceasefire. So they kind of attacked. And this attack was terrible because it caught a woman who's pregnant and her 18-month daughter, and it's a third boy were killed, civilians were killed, and that angered, of course, Hamas, and Hamas, you know, retaliated, and the Israelis retaliated in this kind of cycle of violence and killing in which only Palestinians are killed has happened again, and now they're trying to kind of find ways to reestablish the ceasefire, but As always, ceasefires don't work when you don't have trust, when you have one side is trying to kind of use their power, their extreme power, to force the other side to do things they don't want to do and you want them to do. And in this case, you know, allowing somebody freedom of movement, which is an inalienable right that is guaranteed by the UN, is something that you have to negotiate and fight for every time. So that's what happened.
You know, I wonder then, if there is this deep lack of trust, which obviously there is there anything to look forward to or to be hopeful about?
There isn't much to be hopeful for. There is a dark, dark cloud over us, and it's getting darker because the biggest employer in Gaza is the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA. And UNRWA was hit with a huge financial loss when the U.S. government under Trump decided unilaterally without any kind of planning to stop any kind of aid to the U.N. agency, something they have been supporting for the last 70 years. And not only did they do that, but we've heard or learned from leaked emails of Jared Kushner that, you know, there is a sinister plan behind this, which is that the Trump administration wants to cancel or dissolve the a UN agency, which is mandated by the General Assembly. It's not for the Americans or any other country to decide the fate of the UN agency.
So tell me, let's assume that negotiations are going to start up again. Even if hostilities continue, There are always negotiations of one kind or another. The Egyptians are involved. Maybe the Jordanians might be involved in some way. What is talked about in negotiations like that? It can't all be about a ceasefire, can it? Or are they going to talk about things like hospital access or electricity or food and medicine?
Of course, they will. They are talking about movement of people, of goods mostly, and opening up the borders. The Israelis want Hamas to hand in the bodies of soldiers that were killed in the last conflict. And Hamas is saying, we'll do that, but there are people who were released in the previous prisoner exchange that you rearrested unilaterally. Get them out, and then we can start negotiating. And the Israeli says no. And so they're connecting and basically holding hostage 2 million people because Hamas is refusing to hand in soldiers that were killed during a war 3 years ago. So again, this cycle of violence, the lack of trust, and the lack of communications and the mistrust makes the terrible situation even worse.
One of the things, John, that is so tragic about this, but so predictable at the same time, what Daoud is telling us is there's a celebration going on in Gaza. Gaza's completely controlled. It's really 100%. It's borders, this air above the territory, the water. Everything is under the Israeli control or Egyptian control. So the Israelis, thinking that maybe there's something going on because there's gunfire and it's gunfire during a celebration, the Israelis are like, okay, let's just shoot first and ask questions later. Because guess what? All the dying, all the bleeding, all the suffering will be on the Palestinian side anyway. Then what are the Palestinian forces, the resistance forces, to do? Be bombed and not reciprocate? Of course they reciprocate. And that's what Daoud is talking about, that cycle of violence. But if we step back and say, oh, we have equivalency, there's an equal sign, both sides should stop fighting and forget about the fact that one side has all the power, one side is the occupier, one side has been deemed by the United Nations, by international law, as the illegal occupying force. And in fact, as an occupying force, has absolute fundamental and ultimate responsibility in the areas that it occupies. There's not equivalency.
No, and that's what people forget, that there isn't equivalency. Here in the U.S., when we read our own newspapers or watch our own television news, all we see is Palestinians flying flaming kites or shooting across the border or throwing stones. We don't see the Israeli provocation or the Israeli reaction. We don't see the Israeli jets strafing civilian targets.
Yeah, we haven't seen
any of
those
rockets.
You know, Daoud, when you watch American TV, I have to tell you, you don't see like the snipers, the Israeli snipers, getting their orders, shooting the legs, shooting the arm, shooting the head, shooting the chest, because all of these are very precision precision either woundings or assassinations. The Americans don't see any of that.
But, you know, the simple question, how many Israelis got killed? How many Israelis were injured?
Yeah.
How many Palestinians were killed? How many Palestinians were injured? It's so lopsided. You know, 160 Palestinians were killed, zero Israelis killed. I mean, there is one side with the well-protected behind sniper guns, shooting across an area which they had evacuated and killing people who are unarmed. You know, it's so one-sided and totally in control of one side who has all the power. And of course, yes, Hamas has its, you know, amateur rockets and it shoots amateur rockets. How many Israelis died from amateur rockets? None. Yes, you know, oh, they were scared and they had to move into the bunkers. Okay, yeah, that's true. I mean, it's disrupting their lives. But guess what? You know, two people's lives have been disrupted for the last 10 years. So they're saying if our lives are going to be disrupted, the least we can do is, you know, resist. I'm not defending or opposing what's happening. I'm just saying, explain what is happening. And I think the public needs to know that this is not, as you said, not an equivalency. There's no equity. There's no symmetry. There's one powerful occupier and there is a weak occupied. And then, you know, again, I hate to use this rape story, but, you know, a woman being raped and then scratches the man raping her and you say, oh, she's scratching him. He's, you know, he's using violence against this woman. You know, she's using violence against her rapist. Nobody talks about a woman using violence against her rapist. They talk about the rapist. That has to go to jail or even, you know, more. And so we have rape going on here, and all that they're paying attention to is the scratches on his face because the woman is defending herself.
And John, I know we're out of time, but the other point of, like, to try to get a gauge or a barometer to show the absence of equivalency in spite of the narrative in the media about equivalency is how many Palestinians are in Israeli jails. Mm-hmm. I don't know the exact number. Maybe it's 7,000. Maybe it's 10,000. Dawood probably knows. But how many Israelis are in Palestinian jails?
Yeah, none.
Zero.
Of course.
Zero. I mean, that shows the difference between being occupied and being the occupier.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Amman, Jordan by Dawood Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The count of fatalities in Puerto Rico following Hurricane Maria was initially assessed at 64. But according to a revised report submitted to Congress today, the number of fatalities was actually 1,427. We're joined from Puerto Rico by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She's department chair and associate professor of anthropology at Kalamazoo College. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
The last time we spoke to you, we talked about how the number 64 was ridiculous and just simply not believable. And there were reports from non-governmental organizations putting the death toll at something over 1,000. But did 1,427 surprise even you?
Well, what's surprising is the way that the information came out, really, because the estimate that the Harvard group who had carried out research in Puerto Rico had come to was much higher, was up to over 8,000 at its maximum. They really gave a range. So at the maximum range, it was over 8,000 people. So the number's not really surprising. What's surprising is that it came out because CNN and the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo here in Puerto Rico, Center for Investigative Journalism, sued the government for the documents that actually showed how many people had been recorded as fatalities directly relating from the storm, from Hurricane Maria, in the 4 months after. And the difference in the numbers is because there's some dispute as to who actually gets was counted or as a victim of the storm directly, how many of those people were actually noted as such on death certificates because of the very difficult mortuary circumstances that were in place for months after the storm. And even today, there are still over 300 bodies as we speak that are decomposing and have been reported to be very stinky in five trailers outside of the forensics mortuary in San Juan, Puerto Rico. That is still happening today. And the government finally requested assistance from the federal government. And I read that there are dozens, I think, of pathologists coming to Puerto Rico to perform autopsies on those bodies and categorize those deaths. So it's a very morbid reality that we are still contending with.
One of the problems is the fact that so many people disagree with the various methodologies that have been used to count these deaths. The last time we spoke to you, we talked about a study that was published by Harvard University in which Harvard said that the death toll was probably 70 times higher than the official count of 64. That's probably true. But as you noted a minute ago, they put the deaths at anywhere from 800 to 8,500. The government of Puerto Rico refuses to adopt this new number, however, because they've commissioned George Washington University to come up with their own study using their own methodology and to tell the government of Puerto Rico exactly how many people have died. The issue there is that we're not sure really what the methodology is. We're not sure if this is going to be a scientific study or if it's going to be a survey. And then how do you count the 1,000 more people who died in September and October of 2017 than normal following the hurricane? So if you have 100 people that die in a normal September, and then you have 1,100 people that die in that one September, don't you have to assume that it's in some way because of the hurricane, whether because there was no electricity or no potable water or no food or no medical care or something. So with all of that said, do you think we'll ever really get to the bottom of how many people were killed?
Look, we may never arrive at a final number where we can all agree, oh, this is the number exactly of people that died as a consequence of Hurricane Maria. We may never have that kind of public consensus, but the Puerto Rican people in general have already arrived at a consensus that was adopted from the median number in that Harvard study, which was 4,645 people. That was the center point of their analysis. And that number became an important reference for everyone here in Puerto Rico, who immediately took it up on social media. Artists started producing images with that number. People started wearing t-shirts with that number because it represents at least something like what people felt, the experiences that they had. It represents something more likely, more reasonable, more realistic. Even if it's not finally the ultimately correct number, that number already has served as a kind of rallying cry as well as a kind of place to mourn. You'll remember the shoes demonstration that we talked about some months back or some weeks back, where people actually laid out 4,645 shoes, or I think they tried to get to that number. In a symbolic act of remembrance for all those people who passed away. And so, part of this reflects a scholarly debate around the count for disasters and how you actually account for people who passed away as a consequence of a disaster. But months later, it has to do with governmental inadequacy in terms of people actually not writing down information the way they should have, or causes of death the way they should have, or misdirection from the administration. It has to do with the circumstances. Like I said, some people died under avalanches of mud, or in circumstances where their bodies have still not not necessarily been recovered, or who were buried in people's backyards. So all of those kinds of uncertainties may mean that we never arrive at a particular number that represents accurately the scale of the disaster. But what's important to note is that the government continues to play a kind of game of biding its time, because they admitted also that they knew that the number was higher than 64, and that they commissioned the study in order to get a clearer picture. And I'm not going to prejudge the study that hasn't been published yet. So I can't say anything about that. But it's clear that they're relying on a kind of scholarly ambiguity in the question of how one evaluates the mass casualties from a disaster like Hurricane Maria. They're relying on that ambiguity in order to sort of play a political game around the question of government ineptitude, inadequacy, and a lack of response to the real need of the people of Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, which is, again, a need that continues. Just yesterday we saw news items coming out about school children getting ready to take classes in the very same trailers that I was talking about, where we have dead bodies decomposing. They're also, at the same time as they're closing schools and selling off schools in Puerto Rico, now we get the news that they're also setting up trailers for children to start taking classes in September.
Unbelievable.
So it's unbelievable. It's enraging. And the people of Puerto Rico are fed up, are sick of it. There's already been a teacher strike declared for August 15th. And I'm sure that this is the start of a season of protest that where Puerto Ricans will continue to express their rejection of the political, economic, environmental, and social circumstances that U.S. colonialism has created in Puerto Rico.
We're speaking with Dr. Adriana Garriga Lopez. She is speaking to us from Puerto Rico. She's the department chair and associate professor of anthropology at Kalamazoo College. We've got about 2 minutes left. Tell us what we should be looking forward to as we approach the next hurricane season. What kind of lessons has the Puerto Rican government, or the federal government, even more importantly, learned from Hurricane Maria?
Good question. There's a lot that we need to be watching out for. I think that the question of the schools is fundamental, and the privatization of the energy market in Puerto Rico is really important. That watching that process, protesting that process, critiquing it, monitoring it, having whatever influence we can, and that is really important. It's important that we also put pressure on the EPA. The EPA has recently declared that they're going to stop testing groundwater for toxic coal ash dump sites, not only in Puerto Rico, but also in the United States, in Indiana and Oklahoma. And this is going to affect Puerto Rico severely, that we already have evidence of groundwater contamination from AES, the coal ash company that is operating here in Puerto Rico, and who refused to cover the mountain of products that they have before Hurricane Maria came. So those kinds of environmental battles, I think, are going to be some of the most important places, and they're all to pay attention. And like I said, they go from Puerto Rico also to the United States and other parts of the world. So it's a broad struggle. And I think we need to continue to stand in solidarity with the people of Puerto Rico as they object to the PROMESA created fiscal control board and the financial austerity policies that are strangulating the people of Puerto Rico.
We have 30 seconds left and you get the last word. What's the mood in Puerto Rico? Are Puerto Ricans optimistic about this coming season, or have they been beaten down and they've had enough?
I think the mood here in Puerto Rico is mixed. People are feeling everything from despondency and even fear with regards to the current hurricane season and also the upcoming anniversary of Hurricane Maria. There's a lot of traumatic feeling, I think, that is coming back because of that anniversary. And there's also a lot of commitment to the future of Puerto Rico, to the struggle. There's a lot of people that are involved in community projects and in sustaining each other and loving each other. And so there's also, as always, a lot of beauty and a deep sense of solidarity in Puerto Rico. I think there's a lot of people that are invested in seeing the future of Puerto Rico be one where Puerto Ricans are democratically engaged in its own production.
Okay, that was the voice of Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She joined us from Puerto Rico. She is the department chair and associate professor of anthropology at Kalamazoo College. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Venezuela's Supreme Court has ordered the arrest of former head of the National Assembly, Julio Borges, who currently lives in exile in Colombia. This comes in the wake of a recent apparent assassination attempt against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. We're joined from Mérida, Venezuela by Paul Dobson. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Paul, welcome back.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Paul, what can you tell us about the evidence that has led the authorities and the Supreme Court to Julio Borges?
Well, on Tuesday night, President Nicolas Maduro addressed the nation on public TV. He explained that he had received authorization from the Attorney General's office to disclose and make public a few of the elements of the ongoing investigation into the bomb attempt against his life. So he presented to the country a few original unedited videos and audio recordings, which had been taken from confiscated phones, including two confessions of subjects who have already been captured as part of the investigations. Now, in these confessions from these two subjects, as well as other pieces of video evidence and the audio recordings from the phones, two fairly high-profile right-wing deputies in the National Assembly were named personally. One is Julio Borges, and the other is Juan Requesens. Okay, they both belong to the same party, which is a First Justice Party, a very right-wing. Ultra-right party, some describe it as. Juan Requesens was arrested Tuesday night, and Julio Borges is being sought by Venezuelan authorities. He currently lives in Bogota, Colombia, and allegations claim that he hasn't set foot in Venezuela since at least February this year.
But is he being accused of being one of the masterminds behind the attempt? He's not being accused of standing there piloting the drone, right?
No. In one of the videos, one of the drivers of the drones mentions how he facilitated the passing of the drones from the Colombian border into Venezuela.
Uh-huh.
The subjects who have already been arrested talk of a drone training school in eastern Colombia, close to the Venezuelan border, where they were trained and taught how to manage these artifacts. They then explain how the drones were initially planned to be brought to Venezuela by plane directly into Caracas, but these plans fell apart, and they had to bring them across the land border in the city of Cúcuta, which is a border city. And to do so, they had to obviously get certain permits and so on, which they claim were facilitated by the high profile figure of Julio Borges. So they're accusing him, basically the state there is accusing, or the high Supreme Court is accusing Borges of public incitement, treason, and frustrated intentional homicide are the crimes which he is being accused of formally.
There were also six members of the Venezuelan military who were ordered arrested and charged with attempted first-degree murder. It says here on the Telesur website that they will be judged according to laws against organized crime and the financing of terrorism. So should we expect this conspiracy to grow? Should we expect more people to be arrested in the coming days and weeks?
Yes, well, at the moment, there are around six people who have been arrested. Okay, public authorities on Monday night announced that they have so far identified 19 people in the criminal terrorist cell, which was responsible for carrying out this terrorist attack. Of these 19 people, it's worth pointing out, one of the people they have accused is a gentleman called, Osman Delgado, who is living in Florida, United States. They accuse Osman of being one of the main financiers of this terrorist cell. No? And of course, there are various people who are at the moment based in Colombia. It's worth pointing out as well that equally on Tuesday, a Venezuelan ex-police chief, who is currently in Colombia as well, called Salvatore Lucchesi, confessed when speaking to Reuters of being part of this terrorist cell and of being one of the, in his words, foot soldiers of this Operation Phoenix, which looked to take the life of President Nicolas Maduro.
We're speaking from Venezuela with Paul Dobson. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Paul, I think the United States and Venezuela have an extradition treaty. I know under Chavez, there was an extradition demand for Luis Posada Carriles, the CIA-funded terrorist who, along with his colleagues, helped blow up a Cuban airliner in October 1976 that had the Cuban fencing team on it and other civilians, a plane that had left from Venezuela. The U.S. government at that time refused to extradite Posada Carriles, but there is an extradition treaty. Do you think the Venezuelans will want these people to be extradited?
Yes. Well, President Nicolas Maduro has already stated publicly on the record that he is going to proceed all avenues to get not just those based in the U.S., but also those who are based in Colombia, where there's also an extradition treaty signed, extradited and brought back to Venezuela. Now, whether this happens or not is a different question, though. Now, in the case of Posada Carriles, this didn't happen, despite numerous requests from the Venezuelan authorities. There has been a meeting this week between the Venezuelan Foreign Office and the High Representative of the United States here in Venezuela to discuss such issues. The U.S. government has, at the moment, gone on the record of saying that they are open to investigate any illegal activities within their borders should credible evidence be provided. Now, obviously, the important word there is credible. What do they consider credible and what do they not? But Venezuela has already declared that they are going to push for these people to be extradited, for justice to be brought for this crime.
We're talking with Paul Dobson. We talked a couple of days ago, given the fact that the assassination attempt failed, does this benefit the political position of Maduro and the Bolivarian process? I mean, when you encounter what appears to be a terrorist act, an act of aggression, especially when it fails to achieve its objectives, the perpetrators seem to be pushed into a defensive pose, even if they have the backing of such a powerful a country, maybe not an official backing, but maybe an informal backing, the United States. Anyway, how does it change, if it has changed, the relationship of forces, even temporarily, in Venezuela?
Well, interestingly, both sides, here we're talking about, obviously, Nicolas Maduro and his supporters and the terrorist cell. So I'm not talking about your average opposition supporter, you know, the terrorist cell. Both sides here have claimed victory, surprisingly. Nicolas Maduro obviously said that he has survived, that they didn't achieve their objective, which was to kill him. And he's been able to dismark or take off the mark of one of these violent groupings. The terrorist cell, namely in the words of Salvatore Lucchesi, claim victory because they say that they claim that they have exposed the government as being weak, as being vulnerable, and have for the first time since 1999 got past the presidential guard to some extent and got very close to removing, through violence, the president. In terms of the balance of power politically in Venezuela, well, it's obviously a little bit too early to tell. We've already seen a certain rallying of forces behind Maduro, people who maybe in other factors of his policies would support him, but very critically, you know, today are supporting him in a more patriotic sense, let's say. And this will definitely benefit him, I think. In terms of the middle ground in Venezuelan politics, most of the actors have grudgingly, we could say, come out denouncing the terrorist attack against him, denouncing violence as a political tool. No? And there has been further division within the Venezuelan opposition between those who, like I say, have denounced violence as an anti-constitutional method and those who, such as Julio Borges, who have said that this attack never even happened, that this is a show by the government, they have set it up, it's a montage to justify their actions. And even some sectors who have supported this terrorist attack and who are, in fact, lamenting the fact they didn't achieve their objective. So there's been a big divide between the Venezuelan opposition with regard to the interpretation or the reaction to this terrorist attack.
I want to ask you too, Paul, to tell us a little bit about this legislator, Juan Requesens. Is that how you say his name? And what his involvement was in this? He's actually been detained. He's there in Venezuela, not in Colombia.
Correct, yes. He is. He comes from a background of student leadership in the Central University of Caracas. Like I explained, he's a member of the First Justice Party alongside Julio Borges. He was detained alongside his sister, Rafaela. His sister has since been released by authorities on Tuesday night. Juan Requesens is most famous for his role in the 2014 and 2017 street protests here in Venezuela, which were the violent actions by the extreme right-wing opposition, which looked to overthrow by force the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro. He was a vocal activist in these street protests. There's numerous testimonies and photos of him on the streets, clamoring for this violent taking of power at the time. More recently, he was elected a member of parliament in 2015. And being a member of parliament, he has openly claimed to support efforts for a U.S. invasion to Venezuela. So this is the sort of figure we are talking about. He is being accused, or he was named, let's say, by those who gave testimony in the ongoing investigation into the drone attack, as being one of the key elements who helped facilitate the training of those involved in Eastern Colombia, in the drone training school. Beyond that, we don't have any more details of what he's officially being accused of by the police authorities. But according to the testimony that's been made public, that's his involvement in the operation.
Well, we will leave it there. We were joined from Mérida, Venezuela by Paul Dobson. He is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Brazil's Workers' Party yesterday nominated imprisoned former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva as its presidential candidate, despite the fact that the Supreme Court of Brazil will likely seek to keep him off the ballot. Meanwhile, far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro, who is a frontrunner, chose an outspoken general as his running mate. General Hamilton Mourão has spoken in favor of a military coup in Brazil. We're joined from London by Brazilian-British activist Victor Fraga. He's with Democracy Brazil, UK. Victor, welcome back.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Can you explain to us, sort of in plain English, I guess, what we're looking at here? I'm not one who follows Brazilian politics normally, but even I understand that this is a really important set of developments. Can you explain to our listeners its import?
Yes, absolutely. It isn't easy to explain what's happening in Brazil because the situation in Brazil isn't normal. What we're seeing in Brazil is far from democratic. They're not normal elections. Brazil was under a dictatorship until 1985, and we had the first direct presidential elections in 1989. And we like to believe that we returned to democracy since. But what we're seeing now is a travesty of democracy, because the most important presidential candidate, the most popular president in the history of Brazil, is in prison for a crime he did not commit, for allegedly swindling money for an apartment he never owned. The accusations are Kafkaesque. There's no evidence. There's no hard evidence. The entire process was fraught with illegalities, inaccuracies. The justice system has supported the coup d'état, which removed our democratically elected president Dilma Rousseff 4 years ago. And this is the second stage, the second part of the coup d'état that happened 2 years ago. So 2 years ago, Dilma Rousseff, who was democratically elected, was removed by a gang of criminals who basically bought their way through parliament to get her removed. There's an audio leak. It's been leaked all over the news in Brazil, where Temer, the legitimate president of Brazil, where his right hand, a guy called Romero Jucá, he basically says in this audio that has leaked, "This is a big national deal," referring to the coup, with the support of the Supreme Court and the media. So there's an audio actually explaining that, Temer's best man explaining that this was a coup staged with the support of the Supreme Court, the same one which are trying to bar Lula from running. Lula is in prison, and for a crime he didn't commit. Still, according to Brazilian constitution, he still has the right to run for president. But they're about to make that illegal because the judges in the Supreme Court in Brazil are not acting according to the Brazilian constitution. There's no exaggeration to say that they are criminals in a robe, that they aren't just accomplices. They are very active participants of the coup in Brazil. So obviously this coup, which is part of a much broader anti-hegemonic movement to dismantle the BRICS, to place Brazil back in the backyard of the United States and of Latin America.
That's the voice of Victor Fraga. Victor is a Brazilian-British activist. We're talking to Victor from London about the upcoming elections, which are as murky and as subterranean and twisted, so many Byzantine twists and turns in the last couple of years in Brazilian politics. Yet, Victor, some things are starting to emerge now that we can sort of see. On the one side, we have Bolsonaro, the right-wing candidate. He's nominated as his vice president, General Hamilton Mourão. On the other side, with Lula in prison, as you said, Lula, the founder of the Workers' Party, the most important and popular politician in Brazil, he's in prison. We believe, like you, that he's in prison falsely because of a frame-up, essentially, to push him out of the politics. If he can't run, the Brazilian Workers' Party has now made an agreement with the Brazilian Communist Party that they would have a joint ticket to run together. I want to just talk about, real quickly, because we only have a limited amount of time, talk about Bolsonaro, the right-wing candidate, and especially his vice president, General Hamilton Mourão, And who will be, if Lula's not running, what does it look like for the Workers' Party or the Workers' Party / Communist Party ticket?
Okay, well, calling Bolsonaro right-wing is an understatement. Bolsonaro is an ultra-right-wing candidate. He's openly homophobic. He says gay people are the result of not being beaten hard enough. He's openly racist. He says his children would never marry black people because they've been educated and black people are not even good for reproducing. He says the problem with the dictatorship in Brazil was that it killed, it didn't torture hard enough and it didn't kill enough people. So this man is inhuman in every single way. He has nominated Mourão as his vice president, as his running mate. Mourão stated today that indigenous people are to blame for indolence, for laziness in Brazil, while black people are to blame for sleaziness. And if you look at his picture, you clearly see that he's mulatto, if not black. So what we're seeing here is beyond nasty. In order to promote the coup, they let the ugliest beasts out of the cage. The right wing let the extreme right wing out of the cage to do the dirty job, and that is Jair Bolsonaro. And now the right wing, the party of the former president Fernando Henrique Cardoso, the neoliberal party, they don't know how to get that cage, that beast back in the cage. And so we are left with a man which is far more dangerous than Donald Trump or anyone you can think. He has been elected by an Australian newspaper as the most dangerous, the most toxic politician on earth. And this is no understatement. Someone who openly says that the problem with the dictatorship in Brazil is that it didn't kill enough people.
Yeah. And Victor, let's ask, because we have 3 minutes left. Let's talk about the other side. Lula in prison, if it's ruled that he cannot run, what will happen for the Workers' Party candidate now in a united front with the Communist Party? And because we only have 3 minutes left, talk about them really quickly. And also, Lula is very popular, but can they win? Do they stand a chance without Lula?
Well, Brazil, Lula is extremely popular. Lula is ahead in all the polls, and he would win in the first round. Most people, including myself, will vote either for Lula or for whoever Lula supports. He has now chosen Haddad, who is the former mayor of São Paulo, and Manuela Dávila, who is from the Communist Party, as his running mate. And I think that was a very clever choice. Haddad is far more to the right, to the center. I know Haddad personally. I don't think he's as ideologically left-wing as Lula. I think he's a far more strategic politician. On the other hand, you have Manuela. Manuela is a woman. She's a very young. She's a very clever woman. And she's from the Communist Party, which is, in fact, the longest existing party in the history of Brazilian politics. So it's a very powerful statement. They're basically saying, whatever you do, we're going to carry on fighting. And Lula, even if he's not able to run, he will easily transfer the majority of his votes automatically into whoever he chooses. I personally don't think Haddad is the most ideologically.
Let me jump in real quick, Victor, and ask you this. Lula, you're predicting, if able to run, would win in the first round, meaning he'd get more than 50%. But minus Lula, it doesn't, at least according to the surveys, the polls, it doesn't look like either the ultra-right or the Lula's replacement stand-in will have enough in the first round. Does that mean we'll have a second round of elections? Is that the way you see it? 1 minute left.
Yeah, I think if Lula doesn't run, there's much greater chances of a second round. And Bolsonaro will likely go into the second round. However, I don't think he stands the chance of winning, because while they might have 20 to 25% into the votes, he won't go. Well, I'd like to believe that he won't go beyond that, because what he stands for is just way too reactionary. And I'd like to believe that 75% of Brazil do generally reject him, which is what the polls say. The polls say that 75% of the electorate wouldn't vote for Bolsonaro under any conditions. So I'd like to think that even if there is a second round, Haddad, Lula, and Manuela will win. Even if Lula is in prison, he will continue to be incredibly influential, and it will be a step forward. But anything could happen in Brazil. Brazil is a no man's land right now. Brazil is run by a gang of criminals, and many of these criminals are wearing robes. Well, they're called judges, but they are the perversion of justice itself.
We will certainly watch this subject. That was the voice of Victor Fraga. He joined us from London, and he is with Democracy Brazil UK. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We continue our series called Stories from the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where Dr. Alice Bonner highlights some of the most important episodes in African American history, thus American history. Dr. Alice Bonner joins us in the studio. She is a volunteer docent at the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture. She is a retired professor at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland, and she is a longtime journalist at the Washington Post. On this episode, we're going to talk about Ida Wells, a towering figure in the first third of the 20th century and the last part of the 19th century, a leader of the anti-lynching movement in the United States. She finally gets a memorial in hometown Chicago. Alice Bonner, welcome back.
Thank you.
Ida B. Wells. I mean, certainly until a few years ago, not enough people knew about Ida B. Wells.
Absolutely. Well, she had the good fortune, or maybe the liability, of being born black and female. And those two things together, either of them separately, would have limited her influence and her immortality, so to speak. But both of them were not then, in that Victorian period when she was growing up, something to be. But she managed to parlay those aspects of her life and to be a powerhouse in both the women's suffrage movement and in the racial equality movement. Now, she would have been a child during that lush period of, relatively speaking, of Reconstruction, when opportunities were opening up in so many fronts in ways that we are just now beginning to unearth. There was so much progress because the people who were emancipated at the end of the Civil War were ready and waiting, and so were many of their supporters from outside the South, where 4 million people were set free. Ida Wells was the daughter of a man who was a trustee of the local college, in Rust College in Holly Springs, Mississippi. But her father and mother were victims of a yellow fever epidemic that left her a teenage head of household almost. She did have the support of the local black Masons. She had support of an extended family, including an aunt who, after she had taught in the local schools in her late teens and early 20s, lured Ida to Memphis, where she started writing stories for the church publications that told of racial uplift. She moved that into buying a newspaper with some other people, and in keeping with the reason for being of the black press in this country, starting with the Freedom's Journal, which was the very first black newspaper created in 1827 in New York City, she used the press as an advocacy tool, and she became the foremost anti-lynching sponsor, supporter, warrior, down through that whole period of lynching, and told those stories of people, including her friends, who had been wrongly taken out of jail or taken out of their homes and put to death in these vast, spectacular events that are now being commemorated in Montgomery, Alabama, of course, with a new museum there.
Dr. Alice Bonner is our guest. We're talking about Ida B. Wells, someone that anybody in the United States who knows about George Washington should also know about Ida B. Wells. I mean, this is what you're saying. She's black and female. Those two factors, separately or together, make her more invisible to American history or its presentation. Ida B. Wells, in 1895 pamphlet called The Red Record, Tabulated Statistics and Alleged Causes of Lynching in the United States, she wrote, "During the past 30 years in the South, more than 10,000 1,000 Negroes have been killed in cold blood without the formality of a judicial trial and legal execution. And for all these murders, only 3 white men have been tried, convicted, and executed.
One of the most dramatic events of her anti-lynching crusade, which went on for decades and has been recorded in her autobiography, which was edited by her daughter, Alfreda Duster. She told about a postmaster in South Carolina in taking back the power that had been, that they'd lost in the Civil War. The South, Southerners, Southern officials in many cases, were willing to go to extremes of violence for very small reasons, very small advances by their former slaves. And so in South Carolina, there was a man appointed postmaster general, a federal position. He was literally burned to death, burned alive for having the temerity to rise up to such an important position. And so she protested it to President McKinley, and he essentially shrugged. She put a lot of money after she married at about age 33 to a prosperous Chicago lawyer and newspaper owner, Ferdinand Barnett. She had a better economic situation, and she put a lot of her own personal money and took her child with her, stayed in Washington for more than a month trying to get McKinley's attention to this atrocity. And as she wrote in her autobiography, that effort was finally put aside for the Spanish-American War. And so nothing came of justice for him or his family, the man whose name I now forget.
Alice Bonner, when Ida B. Wells wrote this statistical pamphlet about the number of lynchings, at that time, this was 1895, at that time, there were at least, this is the record, at least 2 lynchings per week. So again, let's think about our younger audience who might not know that this reign of terror, if it didn't impact directly a particular black community, had to be uppermost in the minds of all black communities and all black people, especially in the southern states. But perhaps, as we've said here before, quoting Malcolm X, the South and America starts right at the U.S.-Canadian border. Just this, the psychological impact of the mass phenomena of lynchings, which were sanctioned. You know, the lynchers were not punished. Just talk about the impact, psychological impact.
Well, people had to be afraid, and they were afraid. And that fear perhaps carried down through generations in the DNA, some people now theorize, but it certainly was passed along in the way that children were raised. You've got to be really careful how you behave. And those behaviors required an extreme obsequiousness in the presence of white people that I have seen among my older relatives, that they still have that in their old age. They still carry that fear. I'm from Virginia. And so she put her whole life into it. She would pick up a child she was nursing. She had 4 of her own. And Barnett, who was a widower, had 2, so she raised 6 children. And she would take a child who was an infant, very young infant, and go off to a crusade, go off to a meeting. She organized as a social worker, even though she wasn't trained for that. In Chicago, she organized clubs, and she collaborated not only with Frederick Douglass, who died in 1895, was one of her major mentors, but she also was there with Susan B. Anthony. She approached and collaborated with Jane Hull in Chicago, and there was no one with whom she was not willing to work and aggressively to pull them into her her efforts to change the situation of her people. And many, many people followed her. I have a fantasy, if I may, that someday someone's going to look on the top of some old cabinet or on a shelf and find a 38 RPM record, one of those old thick phonograph records, where someone has recorded the voice of Ida B. Wells. I don't think that it has occurred because I've never heard it and I haven't read about it. But her voice was so powerful that people would do anything, including hire nurses to look after her children so that they could get her on speaking engagements.
It's amazing. And again, we don't know. Not enough people know about Ida B. Wells. Dr. Bonner, there were 200 anti-lynching bills that had been introduced in the U.S. Congress. Three of them passed the House of Representatives. Seven presidents between 1890 and 1952 said that they favored an anti-lynching bill, which would seem pretty straightforward, pretty simple. Don't take people out and hang them from trees or burn them alive stab them or have picnics celebrating their disgusting murder.
No, not controversial.
And
being opposed should not be controversial.
And the U.S. Senate never passed one of them.
Never passed one of them. Well, keep in mind that the U.S. House, the U.S. Congress was still, as it had been through the early history of this country, dominant in the legislature because of the three-fifths rule, so that the slaves were voted for and in favor of slavery and its attendant.
So that boosted Southern representation, a Dixiecrat House of Lords, also known as the U.S. Senate.
And taking back the voting rights, which the 15th Amendment had established for black men freed from slavery, was overridden by local laws and by behavior and by lynchings and any means necessary to put the formerly enslaved people back in their place. And so the South dominated and could have its way. And so it didn't really register that democracy was being trampled upon in all of these actions. And it's no surprise that getting an anti-lynching law, which probably would have been fairly ineffective as federal law.
But even as a symbol, I mean, the fact that the U.S. Senate, I mean, you can't have a democracy and one of the chambers of the democracy refusing to pass a law that says, guess what, it's illegal to lynch people, black people in America. Anyway, we're completely out of time. Time goes so fast. But luckily, Dr. Alice Bonner is going to come back and we're going to continue this series. Dr. Bonner is a volunteer docent at the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture. She is a retired professor at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland and a longtime journalist at the Washington Post.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.